repeated the details of Jodie's disclosures. Sally thanked me for all I was doing and gave me her home telephone number in case anything else should emerge. Finally, the phone stopped ringing. I put the kettle on and tried to settle Jodie with Play-Doh, but she was having none of it. She was high on the frenzy of activity, rightly believing that it related to her. Luckily, Paula and Lucy arrived home from school, and they distracted her long enough to allow me to collect my thoughts. A little while later, the phone rang again. It was Jill. "Hi, Kathy. I'm just calling to let you know the outcome of the strategy meeting. Contact with both of Jodie's parents has been suspended with immediate effect, until further notice. Can you tell Jodie, please?" "So she's not seeing her mum either?" I asked, surprised. "No, until they know more, they're playing safe." "All right, I'll explain to her. Goodness knows how she'll take it. As we said earlier, it would be great if you could try and find out where the mother was while the abuse was taking place." "I'll try. Between you, me and the gatepost, this looks like one hell of a bulls-up by social services. All hell's broken loose while they try to find out how this could have happened." I hung up and looked at the clock. It was already 5:30, and I hadn't even thought about dinner yet. I wearily went through to the conservatory, where Paula and Lucy were doing a good job helping Jodie model the dough. I decided to deal with the contact first, as I didn't want her to feel in any way responsible for not seeing her parents. "I need to have a chat," I said to the girls. "I'll explain later." They took my meaning and left. "Thanks for your help," I called after them.
"I'll explain later," Jodie repeated.
I heard the girls laugh. I squatted down beside her and began talking to her about being safe, keeping safe, and how safe she felt with me. Obligingly, she said,
"I wasn't safe with my daddy, was I, Kathy?"
"No, you weren't, pet. And because of that, Eileen feels it would be better if you didn't see either of your parents for a while until it's all sorted out."
"Okay, Kathy,"
she said, not in the least perturbed.
"I'll tell her."
Then she stood up and started a conversation with herself in which she told Jodie she wasn't seeing Mummy or Daddy because she had to be safe. That was too easy, I thought. It's not normal. After all, she'd been with them for 8 years. I'd dealt with many children who'd been neglected or even abused, and no matter what they'd been through, they always had some emotional connection with their parents. I'd never seen a reaction like this before. I moved on to the second matter of Mum's presence during the abuse. Jodie sat down again and picked up a lump of multicoloured dough. "Jodie, you know what you were telling me earlier? Can you remember where your mummy was while your daddy was in your bedroom?"
"It's a cat!"
she exclaimed, pulling the dough into an elongated pear shape. "Is it? That's nice." I leaned closer. "Jodie, when your daddy was in your bedroom, doing naughty things, where was your mummy?" She shrugged and curled her tongue over her top lip in concentration. "Was she in the house, Jodie, or out? Did you tell her what he was doing?"
"I told her,"
she said, thumping the dough with the palm of her hand.
"I told her. I said I want a cat. Get me one now."
Then she was off in search of Tosha. I didn't pursue it. I'd have to wait until she was ready. Chapter 11. Cooking and Cleaning. In the middle of the night, I was woken by the most terrifying screams. I didn't have time for my dressing gown and slippers. I hurried out of bed and rushed onto the landing, dizzy from standing too quickly. I flung open Jodie's bedroom door. She was on the floor, thrashing from side to side, screaming at the top of her voice, gripped in a paroxysm of fear. "Jodie!" I shouted, trying to break through her nightmare. "Jodie, it's Kathy!" But her screams drowned out my cry. I dropped my knees and took hold of her hands. Her face was screwed shut, and she was clawing at her eyes, trying to gouge them out. I pinned one arm under my knee and the other above her head. She was fighting for all she was worth, and her strength was incredible, as though the demons had risen up to do battle against her. "Jodie, open your eyes! It's Kathy! You're safe with me!" Her teeth gnashed and her feet drummed the floor. I held on and kept talking. "Jodie, you're safe in your room. It's a nightmare. Nothing can harm you here." The screams peaked, then died, and her body went limp. I heard a gush of water, then a stain appeared on her pyjamas. Her eyes flickered open, and her head slowly turned. She looked up at me, fixed and staring, then turned her head and vomited. It was like the end of a seizure. "All right, Jodie, it's okay. Everything's going to be all right," she murmured, and her eyes started to focus. I relaxed my grip and cradled her against me. The smell of vomit and urine made my stomach heave. "You're safe, Jodie. Nothing can harm you here. I'll take care of you. Don't worry, pet." I gently rocked her. She whimpered, then wrapped her arms tightly around my waist.
"I don't want it in my mouth. Tell him. Tell him it makes me sick, Kathy."
"It won't happen again, pet. I promise. You're safe."
"I told her to make him stop. I did. But she wouldn't listen."
"Who, Jodie? Who did you tell?" She started to cry again. "It's okay. Don't worry. You can tell me when you're ready. Only when you're ready, pet." I held her until she was completely calm, then brought her to her feet and led her to the bathroom. I cleaned us both, then helped her into a clean pair of pajamas. She was silent and exhausted. I steered her round the landing and tucked her into bed, then sat on the floor next to her, stroking her hair. Eventually, she fell asleep. I left the light on as I crept out of her room and gently closed the door. I returned to my bedroom for a clean nightdress, my dressing gown and slippers, then went downstairs. It was 3 a.m. Jodie's screams must have woken the others, but they seemed to have turned over and gone back to sleep. In the kitchen, I filled a bucket with hot water, added some disinfectant, and left our nightclothes to soak. There was little point in returning to bed yet. I wouldn't be able to sleep. I was too full of Jodie's suffering, and I half expected her to wake again any minute. I hadn't seen anything like this before in any child I'd looked after, and it had left me stunned and drained. I leaned heavily against the work surface and watched the clock on the oven tick over another minute. Tosha purred around my legs, uncertain if it was time for breakfast. I poured her a saucer of milk, then made myself a mug of tea. My thoughts went to the packet of cigarettes on top of the broom cupboard. I'd put them there when I was giving up 6 months ago. I had managed to quit by only having one when it was essential and making them difficult to reach. I dragged the breakfast stool into place and climbed up. I felt a stab of guilt as I opened the packet and slid one out. The matches were in the childproof cupboard under the sink. I had thrown all the lighters away. I unlocked the back door and stepped outside. I'd never smoked in the house. The night was cold and clear. I couldn't see the moon, but the deep black sky was a blanket of twinkling stars. The cold air was a relief from the heavy atmosphere which now pervaded the house. The match flared in the darkness, as though highlighting my transgression. I held it to the tip and inhaled. I felt that old familiar rush, at once intoxicating and reassuring, then another surge of guilt, but I inhaled again, concentrating on the ritual, allowing myself to think of nothing else. By the time I'd finished, I wasn't sure if I felt better or worse. Returning inside, I put the matches back in the cupboard and secreted the cigarettes in a more accessible drawer. It was still quiet upstairs, so I went into the lounge and switched on the television. There was ice hockey on Channel 5. I turned the volume down and gazed absently, while my thoughts travelled faster than the puck. Whatever had that child suffered? I could only begin to guess. And who was this her whom she had told? Her mum? An aunt? A teacher at school? I was amazed that nothing had been picked up before. Jodie had been on the at-risk register since birth, so she should have been visited by social workers every couple of months. I couldn't believe that none of them noticed anything untoward in her relationship with her father, as it sounded like the abuse had been going on for years. Surely her mother must have known, but that was another avenue that I couldn't bear to go down yet. At some point I must have dropped off, for suddenly the ice rink had been transformed into a weather map, and dark rain clouds were covering most of southern England. The clock in the corner of the screen said it was nearly 6:30, and the house was still silent. Perhaps telling me about the abuse had proved cathartic for Jodie. Perhaps she'd be less disturbed as a result. I crept upstairs and took the opportunity for a long, relaxing shower. As the hot water drummed onto my neck and shoulders, I felt the tension dissipate and prepared myself for a new day. As I dressed, I felt rejuvenated and ready for action. I hung up the towels and heard Jodie stir. Within minutes she was off, screaming abuse and trashing her room. I went in and tried to resettle her. When this failed, I told her off, and when that failed, I ended up having to remove the television as a punishment. Fearful of the damage she might do if left unattended, I allowed her downstairs to breakfast with Lucy and Paula, which turned out to be a massive error of judgment. From the moment she sat down, she tormented the girls by poking and kicking, digging her spoon into their breakfasts, and generally making herself disagreeable. Paula left most of her Weetabix in a bid to escape, while Lucy finally gave her a tap on the hand and flounced off to finish her toast in her bedroom. By the time Adrian appeared, my nerves were in tatters, and my morning serenity had all but vanished.
"What you staring at?"
she demanded as he sat down. Jodie seemed to have a particular fear of being looked at, and was never happy if she felt she was being observed, getting upset with whoever was looking at her. I'd noticed when she arrived that she avoided eye contact and preferred to look at people's chests when they were talking to her. Similarly, she'd never been able to relax, always jumping if someone walked into the room as if she was on constant alert and ready to take flight if she had to. I hadn't really thought about it before, but now, in the light of what she'd told me, everything took on a sinister significance. Adrian shifted awkwardly and concentrated on his breakfast. I saw her grin, that ghoulish contortion of her face. Then, quick as a flash, she scooped up a handful of porridge and hurled it at him. "Jodie, stop that!" I cried, and took her bowl away. "That was naughty. Now I've got to clean his blazer. Look at the mess you've made." She sneered.
"That's what you're here for, to clean and cook. Get on with it, bitch."
Adrian couldn't believe what he'd heard, and neither could I.
"I beg your pardon," I said.
She looked as if she was about to repeat it, so I interrupted.
"Don't you dare say that. If you think I've got nothing better to do than clean up after you, you're very much mistaken. You've lost your television today, and if there's any more, it'll be for the rest of the week."
I washed her hands, sponged down Adrian's blazer, then cleared away the breakfast things. I didn't speak to Jodie or make eye contact with her. I wanted her to feel my disapproval. I appreciated that she had suffered a great deal in her life, but the only hope for her future was for her to try and understand how to function in a normal family and in society. She had to learn what behaviour was acceptable and what kind of treatment of others was entirely wrong. Only when I'd loaded the dishwasher and seen Adrian, Lucy and Paula off to school did I make the peace. No more swearing or throwing things around. Do you understand? It's naughty, and you're not a naughty girl.
No, I'm sorry, Kathy, she said, temporarily chastened.
Okay. Would you like me to read you a story now?
Yes, please, Kathy.
I gave her a hug, and we went into the lounge, where she picked up half a dozen books and dumped them on my lap. We sat side by side on the sofa, and Jodie asked for another hug. I put my arms around her and thought now might be a good time to ask her about her mum, as she was subdued and reasonably cooperative. Before I start, Jodie, I want to ask you something about last night. You remember you were upset and I came into your room? She looked at me blankly, which was nothing unusual, so I decided to continue. You said you told someone about what Daddy was doing. You said you told her to make him stop. She was still looking at me, and her brow furrowed in concentration as she tried to remember. Jodie, who was it that you told? Can you remember? I know it was a woman because you said her. She pulled slightly away and took the top book off the pile.
Three Ickle Pigs. I told the Three Ickle Pigs and they blew my house down.
I smiled inwardly at this quite witty diversion. No, you didn't. Now be sensible. It's important.
Can't remember. Can't. Really, I can't, Kathy.
Okay, darling. Let's read. That afternoon, I phoned Jill and told her I hadn't had any success. She genuinely doesn't seem to remember. I'll have to wait until she's ready. Okay, you're doing everything you can, Kathy. This is not unheard of. In some cases, when a child is emotionally traumatized, the brain can shut down to protect the child from the horrendous memories. Once the child feels safe again, they may be able to release a bit more, but only to the extent that the brain feels able to cope with it. It sounds like a mechanism I could do with, I thought to myself. I finished my conversation with Jill, feeling a little comforted. I could only hope that this was a turning point for Jodie. Now that she'd been able to reveal what had happened to her, perhaps she would begin to get better. I couldn't have been more wrong. Chapter 12. Monsters. It was weeks before Jodie felt safe enough to reveal any more, and during that time her behaviour, far from improving, deteriorated still further. She became increasingly violent, not only towards me and the other children, but also towards herself. For some reason, she frequently became distressed at the dinner table. In the middle of a meal, she would suddenly start clawing at her face or tearing at her hair. At other times, she would scratch and pinch her arms, leaving marks and bruises. I would quickly restrain her, of course, wrapping her in my arms until she calmed down. She was also defecating again. After the first couple of instances, she had calmed down and stopped messing herself, but now it started up again and was worse than before. Now she was simply smearing shit all over herself, and then, if I didn't get to her quickly enough, over the house. There was no apparent pattern or motive, but she did seem to understand that messing up fabrics would lead to a more severe telling off than smearing impermeable surfaces such as the walls or banister. And she appeared to make a point of avoiding getting it on the sofa and curtains. As usual, it was impossible to understand Jodie's motives or even whether she was really aware of what she was doing. As a result of her activities, the house constantly smelled of disinfectant. One evening, as I prepared for bed, I saw that the skin on my hands had become chapped and red, and my fingertips were puckered from all the detergents. This habit of Jodie's was unpleasant for everyone in the house, to say the least, even though we probably have an unusually heightened tolerance of poor hygiene, having dealt with a number of foster children with similar problems. I don't think I'll ever forget the day I looked round one teenage girl's bedroom, trying to find the source of a persistent, nasty smell, when I peered behind her wardrobe and found a stash of used sanitary towels dating back to when she first arrived 6 months before. Despite the violence, the insults, the excrement, the lack of sleep, and numerous other traumas, the children were remarkably patient with Jodie, as they now knew the reason for her behaviour. Shortly after the first disclosures, I sat down with them one evening and told them about the abuse and warned them about some of the additional difficult behaviour we might expect. It was important to tell them because Jodie was as likely to disclose to them as to me, so they needed to be prepared. Besides, they were already hearing things that she had started saying. Just as she had with Nicola, she was beginning to drop casual references about what had happened to her into conversations. I had to tell them what she was talking about. With Paula being only 13, there were certain physical aspects of the abuse that I had to explain to her in detail. When Jodie mentioned her father weeing in her mouth, for example, they had to know she meant oral sex. Not only was this embarrassing for all of us, but I was once again reminded of the potentially negative effect fostering might be having on my children. How healthy was it for Paula to learn about sex in this context? Was there a risk that it might harm her relationships in the future? The children were, as I'd expected, shocked and horrified. I wished that I hadn't had to bring all this into their worlds as well, and it was awful to see them struck dumb as they absorbed the implications of what I was saying. The fact that Jodie's father had done this to her was clearly a difficult and near impossible concept for them to cope with. They were already used to hearing about the difficult backgrounds of other children I'd fostered. It was often important for their own protection that they knew what had happened, but this was beyond all of that. "As you know, this is strictly confidential," I reminded them, and they nodded at me, their faces serious. They'd always understood that anything they learnt in the house had to stay there and was not to be repeated to anyone. I trusted them completely. After we had this chat, the children became even more tolerant of Jodie's behaviour. They tried to spend more time playing with Jodie and remain sympathetic, even when she was screaming at them to get out of my fucking house or lunging at them with a kick. Nonetheless, their patience had limits, and when Jodie interrupted one meal by graphically describing how blood had dripped from her finger when her mother had purposely cut it, Lucy lost patience. "Gross!" she exclaimed. Then she picked up her plate and took her dinner into the living room. One summer's afternoon, when Jodie had been with us for about 4 months, Jill came round for one of our regular meetings. Although, being a link worker, she had no statutory obligation to visit us, unlike Jodie's social worker, good practice dictated that she should come round every 4 to 6 weeks to see how things were going, offer a bit of support and check my log notes. As it was a glorious sunny day, we decided to take Jodie to the park. Despite having been up most of the night with nightmares and general distress, as she often was, Jodie was full of energy and restless to get out into the sunshine. I, on the other hand, was simply worn out. "So, how's she doing?" asked Jill, as we walked through the park's immaculately tended flower garden. Jodie was marching a few metres ahead, anxious to get to the playground and apparently oblivious to the dazzling array of colours and scents around her. "She's getting worse," I replied. "She's having more and more of those hysterical screaming fits, for no apparent reason, and once she recovers she seems barely aware of what's happened. That's why Nicola didn't stay for the tutoring this morning. About once a week Jodie's simply unmanageable, so we have to give up and cancel the session." "And how's she sleeping?" "Oh, not wonderfully. She wakes up at 5, sometimes earlier. She had been learning to stay in her room and play quietly, but over the last few weeks she started having dreadful nightmares, which seem to be more like hallucinations. They're completely real to her, and sometimes they seem to continue after she's woken up. It's awful. You wake up to her screaming and find her writhing on the floor, then she's like that off and on for the rest of the night. It's got to the point where I keep a chair outside her room on the landing, so once I've settled her the first time, I just sit there waiting. If I'm lucky, I get to doze for a few minutes until she starts up again." "You must be absolutely shattered." We arrived at the playground where Jody jumped on a swing and started working herself higher and higher. "Careful, Jody," I warned, then stood with Jill on the grass verge where Jody could see me watching. She had no sense of danger or instinct to protect herself and would swing out of control, then fall off if allowed to. "How did the hearing test go?" Jill asked. I'd taken Jody for a test the previous week, as there had been occasions when she didn't seem to hear what was going on around her. "I think it's okay. We're waiting for the doctor's letter, but the nurse seemed to think there was nothing wrong with her." "So she is shut down?" asked Jill, referring to the way some badly abused children seem to switch off their senses as a way of protecting themselves. If you can't see, hear, or feel anything, it might not be happening. When they shut down in this way, these children become less aware of what's going on around them and less conscious of things that we usually take for granted, like noticing the pleasant taste of food or recognising that the water in the bath is too hot. "I think so," I replied. "There are certainly signs. Hardly anything gives her any pleasure. And she doesn't seem to be sensitive to temperature. Even when it was really cold, I had to fight with her every day to stop her wearing just a T-shirt and shorts. There are days when she is on a relatively even keel, I suppose, though I couldn't describe even those as good days. If we manage to get through a day without a full-scale tantrum, we've done extremely well. That's very rare." Jill looked at me sympathetically. "You're working tremendously hard. I know that. You're doing a brilliant job. You really are." I smiled weakly. Compliments were nice, but what I really wanted was a good night's sleep. I was constantly exhausted, and although my patience was just about lasting out, I felt at the end of my tether. We started walking back, pleased that the outing had so far passed without incident. The sun was still bright, but I was keen to capitalise on Jodie's good behaviour. If we could get home without any drama, it would allow me to praise and reward her, and we could set a positive precedent for how a day out should go. Jill and I each took one of Jodie's hands as we ambled back through the park. "I must admit I'm concerned about the absence of any improvement," I said, using deliberately vague language so that Jodie wouldn't realise that we were talking about her. "The disturbances are getting worse, especially at night." "And have any of the disclosures dealt with the maternal presence, as we discussed?" "No. She tells me about those events time and time again, but there's hardly any new information coming out. Frankly, I'm worried sick. Things seem to be getting worse rather than better. Is there no practical advice you can give me?" I tried to keep the edge of desperation from my voice. "No more than you're already doing," Jill said sympathetically. "And to be honest, there's a limit to what you should be expected to cope with. It's quite possible that the emotional trauma is so severe that only a therapeutic unit can put it right. I tell you what, I'll have a look and see what's available. I won't do anything, I'll just have a look." As we reached the corner of my street, I allowed Jody to run ahead while Jill and I walked in silence. I had been hoping for some practical advice, but the level of Jody's disturbance seemed to be outside Jill's experience too. I was disappointed, but I vowed to press on. I saw Jody had stopped further up and was crouching with her back to me, intently focused on something in the gutter. "Jody," I called, "what are you doing? Come here." She turned around, grinning, then held up a dead pigeon, proudly displaying it like a trophy. The bird's head slumped sideways, and its breast had been torn open so that its bloody insides were exposed. Jody stared at it, fascinated. "Jody, put that down right now," I said firmly. She stared at me, then slowly turned away, poking at the pigeon's bloody flesh, and dropped it back in the gutter. "Yuck!" Jill said. I cupped Jody's elbows in my hands from behind and steered her, arms outstretched, towards the house. Jill got straight in her car without coming in, as she had another meeting to go to. I manoeuvred Jody in through the front door and straight to the kitchen sink. She looked up at me as I filled the bowl with hot water and soap.
"We had a nice time at the park, didn't we, Kathy?"
Her face was flushed, happier than I'd seen her in weeks. I smiled back. I couldn't be angry. After all, she hadn't really done anything wrong, but I was concerned at the ghoulish fascination the dead bird had inspired. The next morning it was clear early on that something was different. Jodie wasn't screaming at 5 o'clock, nor 6, nor 7. I had time to shower, dress and dry my hair. I made the children's packed lunches and even drank a cup of coffee in peace. Then I started to worry. I crept up the stairs, tiptoed to Jodie's door and listened. There was silence. She wasn't even talking to herself, which she usually did continuously, even in her calmer moments. I knocked and went in. She was lying on top of the duvet, flat on her back, with her eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling. She was so still that for a moment I feared she could be dead. "Jodie?" I shook her shoulder. "Jodie!" She gave a small twitch at the corner of her eye. "Jodie, what's the matter? Are you ill?" She didn't move. Her arms and legs were held straight, so stiff it was like they were encased in concrete. I knew this wasn't a fit, or at least not like any fit I'd ever seen. I placed my palm on her forehead. It was warm, but not feverish. "Jodie, can you hear me?" I shook her again, this time more robustly. "Jodie, look at me. Tell me what's wrong. It's Kathy." "Jodie, can you hear me?" She blinked, then slowly turned to look at me. Her pupils were dilated, and there were large dark rings around her eyes. When she spoke, it was in a flat monotone.
"He came here last night. You said he wouldn't, but he did. I know. I know who it was."
I knelt down and held her hand tight.
"No, sweet. No one came here. You've remembered something, and it seems real." "I didn't tell. I didn't tell because she saw. She saw, Kathy. She saw and didn't stop him."
"Someone saw Daddy do naughty things to you?"
She nodded.
"Who, sweet? Who was it?"
She stared straight at me, eyes wide with terror, her cheeks deathly pale. I could see the pulse throbbing in her neck.
"Mummy. Mummy saw. I said, make him stop, but she didn't. She laughed and watched. They all did."
I turned cold. "They? There were others there?"
"Uncle John and Ken and Aunt Belle. They took pictures when Uncle Mike did it."
"Uncle Mike?" Her face was blank. She was looking at me and talking, but it was as though she was in a daze.
"He lay on me, same as Daddy. I didn't want to. It hurt. Daddy held me when it was Uncle Mike's turn. I was shouting and screaming, so Daddy put his thing in my mouth. Aunt Belle said, that'll shut her up, and they all laughed."
She was shaking with fear. I tried to hide my horror and concentrate on what I was hearing. I needed to make sure I remembered all the names and details to get as much evidence as I could while she was talking. I didn't know when or if she would open up again. I stroked her forehead and whispered words of comfort. "Jodie, you're safe now. The doors are locked and bolted. We have a very good alarm. No one can get in. What they did was the most dreadful thing any adult can do to a child. They are very wicked people, Jodie." She nodded, but without conviction.
They gave me lots of sweets and toys.
She glanced at the overflowing toy boxes.
Did they buy all these? I asked.
She nodded again.
So that's what they were. Not presents. Not things designed to bring pleasure. They were bribes to buy silence and compliance. No wonder they meant nothing to her.
Jodie, good adults don't buy children presents because they've done bad things to them.
Was it to stop you telling?
It was our secret. They said if I told, horrible things would happen. I'd be taken to a dark cave and a monster would come and chew off my arms. Will he, Kathy?
Her voice rose fearfully.
Will he come here and bite my arms off?
No, absolutely not. The only monsters are those people, and they won't come anywhere near you ever again. I promise, Jodie.
She thought about this, and then a sad smile crossed her lips.
Aunt Belle was nice. She didn't do things. She only watched.
I shuddered at this twisted logic. That's just as bad, Jodie. She watched you being hurt and didn't help. She should have stopped them. That's what I would have done. Where were they when they were watching?
In my bedroom.
And the car? You once said something about a car. Who was in the car, Jodie?
Mummy and Daddy. Mummy took the pictures of Daddy and me. It's a very big car. We was in the back. It was dark. I don't like the dark. The camera made it light up. Will he be told off, Kathy?
I sincerely hope so, sweet. All of them.
I'll tell your social worker, and she'll tell the police. The police will want to talk to us, but don't worry, I'll be with you.
I was still holding her hand and stroking her forehead, reluctant to let go.
It was well after 7, and I should have been waking the others for school.
Is there anything else you want to tell me now? You've been very brave, and it's important you tell me if there is.
She shook her head. I cuddled her for some time, then gently eased her into bed and tried to focus my mind.
Kathy,
she said suddenly.
Yes, sweet. Did your daddy do those things to you?
No, absolutely not, I said. Never in a million years. He's a good, kind man. Most adults are.
And Paula and Lucy's daddy?
No. Paula's daddy never hurt her. Lucy's daddy hit her, which is why she's here. But he didn't hurt her like that.
Was it my fault, Kathy? I didn't want to. Mummy said I was lucky. She said it was because he liked me so much. She said I should belt up and enjoy it. She said I was Daddy's girl.
She was wrong, Jodie. Parents cuddle their children to show their love. They don't hurt them. And it wasn't your fault, Jodie. Don't you ever believe that.
I gave her another hug. Then she asked for the television, and for the first time since arriving, she seemed content to stay in bed while the others got up. I left her room and stood for a moment on the landing, trying to compose myself. I was ice cold and trembling with rage. I could see Jodie being held down by her father. I could see the others watching. I could hear their laughter. It was little wonder she was in the state she was. I knew now where her anger had come from, and I now shared it. I had not wanted to believe it could be any worse than Jodie's father subjecting her to the vile act she had described, but now, to my horror, I realised that it was much, much worse than anyone had suspected. She had been the victim of the most awful kind of abuse I could imagine, where not just one of her parents subjected her to the most degrading treatment any child could suffer, but where both of them were complicit, and so were other adults.
I could feel the nausea churning in me as I realised that it was not only her parents, in their position of precious care and trust, but many others who had conspired to turn Jodie's world into a nightmare of suffering and perversion. They had reversed everything that should be good in a child's life, turning it into something so deeply wicked and evil that I couldn't find the words to describe what I thought of it. No wonder the poor child had cut off the world around her. No wonder she had no sense of being able to relate to other people, when all she had experienced was cruelty and pain. No wonder she tried to beat herself, maim herself, and smeared herself with filth. What else had she ever known? Somehow I made breakfast and saw Adrian, Lucy and Paula off to school. As soon as they were gone, I phoned Jill and told her everything. "It's worse than we thought," I said. "Much worse." As I reported what Jodie had said, I could sense Jill taking in the scale of what had happened. She breathed in sharply as I told her that Jodie had been abused by a circle of complicit adults, photographed and watched and jeered at. "Oh, my God, Kathy, I can't believe what that child has been through. This should be enough to start a police prosecution," she said. "I know it must have been awful to hear all this from her, but you've done a great job." I didn't feel like I'd done a good job. I felt as if I'd been party to Jodie's suffering. I felt ashamed to be an adult. "Do we know how long it's been going on?" she asked. "I think quite a while. She asked if my father did it to me and was surprised he didn't. The way she describes it, it sounds like it was the norm, part of everyday life, and it's only now she's realising it's wrong." I paused. "Jill, at what age can a child be raped?" "Any age. There are cases as young as 6 months." I cringed. "Kathy, this has all the hallmarks of a paedophile ring. Was she ever shown the photographs?" "Not as far as I'm aware. She didn't say." "Okay, write it all down when you have a chance. Eileen's on annual leave." "Again?" "Yes, so I'll speak to Dave Mumby. They'll want a forensic medical and a police memorandum interview. I'll get back to you. How are you coping, Kathy?"
"A damn sight better than Jodie. Bastards!"
Chapter 13. Integration. There's a joke among foster carers that goes like this. How many social workers does it take to change a light bulb? 13. One to find the bulb, and the other 12 to hold a meeting to discuss how best to change it. It's not much of a joke, admittedly, but it does encapsulate how we often feel about the inability of social services to take action when it's most needed. Following Jodie's latest disclosures, Dave Mumby wanted to set up a meeting, but not until Eileen could be present, which wouldn't be until well into the following week, as she was indeed on annual leave. As Jodie's social worker, Eileen had a statutory obligation to visit Jodie in placement every 6 weeks, and yet the two had still never met. Although Eileen phoned every now and then to get a report on Jodie's progress, I got the impression that it was more to save herself the trouble of having to visit us than any real interest in the case. Perhaps she had a very busy workload, but then so did all social workers. Or maybe she was better than most at not getting too personally involved in a case. Whatever it was, it not only saddened me that Jodie didn't have a social worker to take an interest in her and champion her cause, but it was also highly unprofessional. I wondered if Dave Mumby, her team manager, knew. Jill reported back to me that the nature of the meeting meant that I wouldn't have to attend, and she would represent us both. In the meantime, she said, Dave had asked if I could focus my attention on finding Jodie a school, as her parents had made a formal complaint about her lack of education. Jodie had left her previous school when she was taken into care, and the speed of her various moves, then her behaviour, had precluded finding her a new one. I was flabbergasted. Jodie's parents would now know what they were accused of. When a child makes an accusation, the parents are always informed of the nature of the allegation. Moreover, when all contact between Jodie and her parents was abruptly stopped, the reasons would have been given. I was doubly amazed that Dave was acting upon this as a priority while delaying the meeting.
Jill suggested that I try Harvest Bank, which was a local primary school with a good record for taking children with learning and behavioural difficulties. Jodie already had a statement of educational needs, which is a document outlining the child's particular needs, completed after he or she has been assessed by an educational psychologist. Jodie's needs were severe enough that her statement authorised funding to pay for a full-time assistant in whichever school accepted her. This meant, in theory at least, that a school might have an additional incentive to take her if they were short on funds. I phoned Harvest Bank and spoke to the deputy head. She was a pleasant lady who explained very nicely that they had more than their quota of special needs children and were stretched to the limit. She suggested I try again in 6 months' time. I thanked her and hung up. Opening the yellow pages, I highlighted all the primary schools within reasonable travelling distance and began making the calls. The next four schools gave me the same response. Each of them was over their quota, and there was a waiting list. So much for the sweetener of extra funding. I set the phone down and took a deep breath. I wondered if I should approach the school Adrian and Paula had gone to. It only had a small special needs department, but they knew me and my family, and I had had a good relationship with the staff. I took another deep breath and dialed the number. The secretary remembered me, which was nice, and she put me through to the headmaster, Mr. Rudman. We exchanged a few pleasantries on the passing of time, and he asked me how Adrian and Paula were doing. I said they were doing well, and buttered him up by telling him what fond memories they had of the school. "I'm still fostering," I said, and then explained about Jodie, adding that although she had behavioural problems, I had found them manageable. I made light of the rapid succession of foster carers and said his was the first school that had come to mind. A little white lie, but in aid of a good cause.
"I'll see the statement," he said, "although you appreciate I'm not offering a place. It will depend on the level of provision and whether we can best meet her needs."
I thanked him effusively, then phoned Jill to arrange for the statement to be faxed over. Buoyed by this, and in dire need of some exercise after nearly an hour on the phone, I rescued Jodie from the congealed heap of paper, glue and paint which had kept her occupied.
"It's a dog!" she exclaimed.
"That's lovely. Now we're going for a walk to the post office." I helped her wash her hands, then brushed her hair and changed her top. By the time we left the house, she looked quite presentable in a smart yellow T-shirt which I knew was one of her favourites. There was a pleasant breeze as we walked up the street, but Jodie was anxious and grabbed my hand as a car drove past.
"Cathy," she said.
"Yes, Jodie."
"Is my dad hurting my mum?"
"I hope not, Jodie," I replied, uncertain quite what she was asking.
"He is,"
she responded.
"Poor mummy."
We carried on walking, and I watched Jodie as she frowned, apparently still troubled by this idea. Eventually, she looked up at me.
"I don't want him hurting her," she said,
then jutted out her chin and clenched her fists.
"I'll kill him!"
Again, I wasn't sure what to say. Did she feel guilty about leaving her mother to deal with her father alone? Should I correct her anger or encourage her to face these issues? It might not have been very professional, but my personal feeling was that she had every right to feel angry and every reason to want to kill him. I decided to address the possible guilt. If he hurts her, Jodie, I think she should leave him and tell the police. But she's an adult and she can make that decision for herself. I hoped she understood what I was trying to say, but then I wasn't even sure what she was telling me. Was she hinting at domestic violence? Perhaps she had seen her father hitting her mother, or perhaps she had witnessed them having sex and assumed it must hurt her mother as much as it hurt her. I changed the subject to something lighter as we reached the high street. We walked past the various shop fronts with their colourful signs and enticing displays, and I remembered how excited I'd felt as a little girl being taken out shopping by my parents. I could still remember my initial thrill at the strange sights in the fishmonger's window and the mysterious smells at the shoemender's. I looked sadly at Jodie, who was staring straight ahead, alert for danger and oblivious to the sensory pleasures around her. The world was not a place she could enjoy like any normal child. It lacked excitement and stimulation for her. She had been deadened to everything because of what she had suffered. It was heartbreaking. I did what I had to do at the post office, and because she had queued patiently by my side, I bought Jodie a packet of Smarties as a reward. As we walked back down the high street, I noticed she had gone quiet again. "What shall we do when we get home, Jodie?" I asked. She was silent, and I could see her face had set. "Is something the matter, Jodie?"
"What were they staring at?"
she muttered.
"Don't stare at me."
"Who, Jodie? In the post office?" I asked. She didn't contradict me, so I continued. "But no one was staring at you, sweet. They were probably just looking at you because you look so smart in your lovely T-shirt." She didn't respond, so I decided to leave it. You could never really persuade Jodie of anything or have any kind of discussion with her. Caring for Jodie was rather about coping with her needs and trying to distract her before she could get too upset. We walked a little further as a middle-aged man in a suit came the other way.
"What's he fucking staring at?"
Jodie muttered as he approached. As far as I could see, the man didn't seem to be looking at us at all. "Jodie, don't be rude." As the man got closer, she said it again, louder this time.
"What's he blimmin' staring at?"
He must have heard this time. I smiled at the man apologetically and he looked away, embarrassed. "Jodie, that was rude. You've no reason to worry. No one was staring at you."
"I'll show 'em," she muttered. "No one'll stare at me. I'll kill 'em all."
Jodie's mood didn't improve once we got home, but for some respite, I let her watch Mary Poppins, which was her favourite video, while I did some chores. I put on a load of washing and began emptying the dishwasher, all the while wondering about Jodie's strange behaviour. I had noticed before that she seemed to have a particular anxiety about being stared at. This was one reason why mealtimes had become so unbearable, as she would constantly bark, "What you staring at?" to anyone looking even vaguely in her direction. I had suspected that this anxiety might have been linked to the abuse, but now, as the extent of it was revealed, her phobia became even more understandable. If there had been a number of people present watching Jodie, it was no wonder if she had a horror of being looked at. After about half an hour, I had finished what I needed to do and joined Jodie in the living room, bringing with me a carton of Ribena. She was staring blankly at the screen while Bert serenaded Mary as they strolled through the magical chalk landscape. After a while, she turned and looked at me and then came and sat next to me on the sofa.
"You know, you've got really little eyes," she said.
"Have I?" I said, surprised. If anything, I had always felt my eyes were one of my better features, and I was rather proud of them.
"Yeah, really piggy little eyes, like a little pig. Oink, oink,"
she grinned, as if expecting me to join in the hilarious joke. "That's not a very nice thing to say, Jodie. Don't be rude. We don't make personal remarks in this house."
"But you have. Stupid little eyes. That's why you can't even see where you're going, stupid."
This was a strange thing to say, and it sounded like something Jodie must have heard before, an insult that had been thrown at her and that she was now mimicking. Apart from being inaccurate, it had a level of detail and logic which Jodie wouldn't have been able to come up with. Was this something Jodie had been told at home? Before I could pursue this, the phone rang. Oh no, I thought, it will be the school calling to tell me there isn't a place after all. Only a rejection would have come so quickly. I smiled and tried to sound bright. "Hello," I answered.
"Hello, is that Margaret Brown of Boehm Close?"
I looked anxiously at Jodie. It was my address, but Margaret Brown was the name of Jodie's mother. "No, it's not. Who's this?"
"Oh, I'm sorry, my mistake. I'm calling from Ear, Nose and Throat at St John's Hospital. About Jodie Brown?"
"Yes, this is Kathy Glass, Jodie's carer."
"Sorry, I've just found the note on the file. The doctor's letter is in the post, together with a prescription for some ear drops. Doctor wants a follow-up appointment for Jodie in a month."
I made the appointment, noted it in my diary, and hung up. I wasn't happy. I had given specific instructions to the hospital that my details should be kept confidential and, to avoid confusion, should be kept separate from Jodie's parents. It was clear that this hadn't happened. This time, they had called me asking for Margaret, but next time they might just easily call Margaret asking for Kathy Glass. All she would then need to do would be to ask the receptionist to confirm her latest address, and she and her husband would be led straight to my door. Then, Jodie and I would have bigger things to worry about than my piggy little eyes.
Chapter 14. The Park. Eileen returned from her holiday and Dave was finally able to convene his strategy meeting. Jill attended in my place and things suddenly started to happen. I was told to make a number of appointments for Jodie. First, she would have to be assessed by a child psychologist to help the social services decide how best to proceed with her case. She would also have to have what's called a memorandum interview. This is a videotaped interview with a police child protection officer, which in this case would be the starting point for a criminal prosecution of Jodie's father and hopefully the other abusers too. Jodie would also have to see a police doctor for a forensic medical, an intimate gynaecological examination to verify her claims. I immediately started to worry about the forensic medical. It was traumatic enough for an adult to be examined in this way, but for an abused child it could be seen as another assault. I'd given Jodie my promise that nothing of that kind would happen to her again, and I was frightened that she would think I'd broken my word and lose her trust in me. In the meantime, our days had settled into something of a routine. On Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, Jodie's tutor would come in the morning, and then in the afternoon we would go out, usually to the park. On Tuesdays and Thursdays we went shopping, although Jodie and I had somewhat differing views about this. Jodie enjoyed shopping more than anything, whereas for me it was perfunctory. Jodie seemed to relish causing a scene in public, aware that there was little I could do in response. These tantrums were designed to bully me into buying her something, but I could never give in, as this would set a precedent by rewarding bad behaviour. However, Jodie had clearly used this technique successfully for years, so I wasn't expecting her to unlearn it any time soon. The sessions with Nicola were improving in terms of Jodie's behaviour, but she was making little progress in her education. In my view, this lack of progress was only partially attributable to Jodie's learning difficulties and delayed development, and more likely a result of her emotional state. A further problem was that Jodie seemed to have no interest in learning. She could never see the point of any of Nicola's exercises, and it was very difficult to motivate her, as she apparently had no desire to win approval. My worries increased one afternoon when I did finally receive a call from Mr. Rudman's secretary. He was dreadfully sorry, but he didn't feel able to offer Jodie a place. Back to the